On Faith's Edge, Episode 3, today we ask the question, can the Bible be relied upon as historically accurate? Hold up, wait a minute,
put a little love in it. This is On Faith's Edge, where engaging, enlightening, and entertaining content brings us closer to living an authentic faith. We'll talk faith and life with people in business and entertainment as we work out the space where God and life collide on Faith's Edge. And now your host, Joe Taylor.
Host, I feel more like I'm trying to ride a horse wearing nothing but a cowboy hat and a Speedo. Awkwardly exposed and terribly uncomfortable. Oh boy, that's a visual we don't need. I am Joe Taylor, recovering atheist, fellow stumbler, and your servant in Jesus Christ. Thank you so much for stopping by On Faith's Edge. Today we have a really meaty segment with Michael Minot as we ask him, can the Bible be relied upon as a historical document? We cover how did we get the Bible? How did these particular 66 books become known as the holy word of God, these letters and writings and books, how did they become known as the Bible? We ask how the Bible is used as a historical document by scientists and by archaeologists, and how they actually use the Bible as a historical document. We even discuss the issues of miracles in the Bible and why these miracles are considered historically accurate. I think you'll really be impressed with Michael's answers. I hope you're having an absolutely amazing week. I'm doing pretty good myself. This week, I'd call myself very medium. I had a conversation with my daughter this week regarding a post we both read on Facebook. Now, personally, I have a lot of respect for people that make bold, overt statements about their faith, but this particular statement caused an absolute firestorm on Facebook, on this particular Facebook thread, and it prompted a passionate conversation between my daughter and me about the biblical roles of men and women. It could be considered very disrespectful to women in almost every circle, both Christian and secular. Now I got to hand it to this young man. He was being authentic in his statement. He really believed what he said he believed, what he was stating. So to a certain extent, I have to honor that, because I genuinely think he was being authentic in what he believed. Now, I respect women. My mother was a woman. All my daughters are women. Even my wife. She's a woman. I'm surrounded by women. I'm the father of three amazing daughters, all raised and being raised as strong, independently thinking women. Maybe a little too independent sometimes, but that's okay. I've always encouraged them to think about their faith and wrestle why they believe what they believe. Two things came from my discussion with my daughter. The first thing, what is indeed the biblical role of men and women? And do they apply today? In today's context, in today's environment, and in today's world, or do they just apply to the context of the Bible and when the Bible was written thousands of years ago? Also, what is the responsibility we have as believers, if indeed you are a believer, to frame our faith in a way that doesn't whitewash the scriptures, but also communicates it in a manner so that it will be received? I want to hear from you, folks. I invite you to go to onfaithsedge.com and leave your comments. All right, without delay, let's go right into our time with Michael Minot as we ask the question, can the Bible be relied upon as a historical document? Hello, Michael.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on your show again.
I appreciate you. I appreciate you coming back. Hey, how's things going? Your week doing all right?
Things are going well. We had talked last week about the Colorado fires, and so I wanted to ask that the prayers continue for those who are thinking about us. I have friends who have lost all of their worldly possessions, including intellectual property. People were not able to get back to their houses before things burned down. So as I mentioned, the worst fire in Colorado history with respect to number of houses that were destroyed, almost 500. So a lot of people who are redirecting their lives and trying to find out what they are going to do next, considering the devastation that occurred.
I got to ask, you know, of course we'll pray, and we'll ask everybody out there to pray for these folks, but not that prayer's not practical, but practically speaking, is there anything that people can do to help? Is there any foundation set up? Any kind of place that people can go donate money or clothes or whatever, just whatever's needed?
I think if a word search with the words Black Forest Fire, and there would be a number of those organizations that would come up. I don't have any of them that I have available now that I can give to you, but I know there are a number of them, and some of them are accepting different types of donations, different types of helps for these folks. And so it's just a matter of doing a word search with Black Forest Fire, and I think those organizations will come up.
Let's not only remember those folks in prayer, but wherever we can provide the resources that God has blessed us with, let's share those resources in a way that God has intended us to share those resources. Having said that, let's go ahead and get started in the show.
Yes.
I wanted to take a minute, if we could, and just get to know you a little bit, Michael. You are a former atheist turned believer in God, specifically the God of the Christian Bible. And I don't know if you call yourself this, but just knowing a little bit about you, I would call you a Christian apologist. But from your own words, Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was raised in a family where my parents did not believe in the existence of God, and I continued along that same path. I was the oldest of four children, went through school, and was pretty much doing my thing, trying to find my way in the world and what I was going to do, and finished up law school and ended up starting to practice law. And someone challenged me a few years after that, knowing that I didn't go to church or believe. And he said, you know, the scriptures mean a lot to me, and you're at a unique place in your life. Michael, you no longer are studying until midnight for your exams in law school. You don't have a roommate, and you're not married with children. It's a unique time. Those things are going to change. You will have, in all likelihood, a wife and children in the future. And so a lot of your time is going to be taken in a way that it's not at that time. This was in my late 20s. So he challenged me to read the scripture, and that wasn't something that I thought I wanted to do, but he was absolutely right that was a unique time in my life. So I decided to do that, thinking that I would find ways to bolster my belief that there was not a God. It took me many months of reading scientific material, as well as the scriptures, and studying both. And eventually I came to the conclusion that it was more likely than not that I was a created being. The perfection and order of things that I saw in science, from the smallest of the small, including the DNA type of order in cells and the functions of DNA, and all the way up to the things in the cosmos, from the order of our solar system and other types of cosmology issues and everything in between, there was just too much there for me to deny, as I had not looked into those things in the past. Also, I found the scriptures to be orderly and tell a story that I did not know previously. Combination of all these things is that suspicion, that strong suspicion, became even stronger over a period of a short number of other weeks after that, and I came to the belief that it's far more likely than not that I was a created being. And so that's what happened. And that was a little more than 20 years ago, and I've been reading more and more since then just to see if I was right. And I'm pretty sure that I am.
So you've been on this.
I say that tongue in cheek because I'm,
you're firm
I'm certain
in your
that
faith.
That's the case, and that's how I'm living my life, and that's how my wife and I, we live our family life that way as well.
Firm in your faith.
Yes.
You know, I'm just curious. We're not going to dig too far deep into this because I certainly want to get to the question of the day. But why the Christian faith, Michael? Why the God of the Bible?
Well, at the time, that's what I was challenged to read, is the scriptures, which we know as the Old Testament and the New Testament. I did not read the Quran or other holy books to the same extent that I read the scriptures. But first and foremost, I came to the belief from science that those explanations that I had as to why we are human beings were not nearly as likely to be accurate as what I was determining was now more accurate, which is that I'm created. Now, that there are two other monotheistic religions, which would be the Jewish faith, as well as Islam. But in studying those, briefly, I came to the conclusion that it was the God of the Bible with both the Old Testament and the New Testament, which was that creator.
Coming up, we'll continue our time with Michael Manat, asking him, can the Bible be relied upon as historically accurate? All right, we're back with Michael Manat. Let's get right into the meat of today's show. Michael, here's the question we have for you. Can the Bible be relied upon as historically accurate? Now, this is such a broad scope issue, I know, and we're in the time that we have here, we're not going to give it exhaustive justice. How about that for a word to an attorney? We're not going to be able to give it exhaustive justice in the time we have here, but let's take as much as time needed to be reasonably fair. Fair enough?
That's fair.
All right. So can the Bible be relied upon as historically accurate?
I've determined that it's historically accurate, and there are a number of things that I believe to be persuasive, and one of the things that was just absolutely outstanding to me when I was doing my investigation, and I have learned much more about this since, is the prophecies that are in the Bible. There are approximately 1,000 prophecies, 800 in the Old Testament and 200 in the New Testament, and the majority of those have proven to be true, and none have been proven to be inaccurate. So there are still some yet where the prophecy has not been fulfilled, but the prophecy is not meant to be fulfilled yet. So the detail in which some of these prophecies were made and the time that they were made and what logic said at the time was that this was an outstanding type of statement, that something like what these prophecies were foretelling would in all likelihood not be a rational way of thinking at the time they were made, but ultimately that's exactly what happened, which is how these prophecies were set out. I group them into two different ways. There's the messianic prophecies, which spoke about the Jewish Messiah coming to earth, and there's a number of groupings even within that, which is the coming of the Messiah and also what the Messiah would do during his life and then how his life would end. So really there's three groupings there. And then there's all the other prophecies. So just by way of example, Daniel living in the 7th century B.C. was prophesied as to how the Greek Empire would end. And 300 years later, his prophecy of how the division of the Greek Empire occurred and how two of those parts would then war against each other for the possession of what is now the Holy Land or Palestine was deemed to be just fanciful or something that was way out in left field, so to speak, and ultimately that came to pass. There's some other dynasties like the Babylonian Empire that was prophesied as to how it would end, which came true as well. I think that's from the book of Isaiah. So I'm giving you a sampling of hundreds and hundreds of prophecies. There's also things that can verify the writings, such as miracles. There are some that would say the fact that miracles are testified to in the Old Testament and New Testament actually gives it less credibility, but I would suggest that it gives more. Reason being is that the way that these miracles were recorded and where they occurred and who saw them and witnessed them from an evidentiary standpoint, I find that out of these hundreds of miracles, especially those that occurred and performed by Jesus, because those are the most recent ones that are recorded, that there were so many and before so many people that I would expect that people that were around at the time would object, saying that they didn't occur in the event that they didn't occur. You know, from the courtroom, we know that the more witnesses, the greater the credibility. And some of these miracles were witnessed by many, many people. And there was even reaction to those miracles by people who would oppose Jesus. So these are some of the things that we have. Thirdly, let me mention that the Bible is full of history. By history, I mean people, places, and things. And these people, places, and things over time through secular writings, which we have known about for many hundreds of years, but more recently, the archaeology finds that we have and the digs that are occurring that verify that the people, places, and things mentioned in the Bible are accurate is a third area of scholarly research that verifies the historicity of the Bible.
I want to back up just a little bit. I just want to ask you a question about something you said earlier. You talked about prophecy, and you made a pretty bold statement. You said that, I'll paraphrase here, you said, basically, every prophecy that has come true in the Bible has been accurate, meaning, you know, it hasn't come out any differently than what the Bible foretold it would come out.
Of the approximate 1,000 prophecies that we could mine out of the words in the Bible, the majority of them, I do not have those counted, but the majority of them have occurred in the way that the prophecy was written. In other words, the prophecy has been verified to be accurate and true. It accurately foretold of events to occur in the future. Now, there are some of the 1,000 prophecies that are in the Bible that have not been, that have not occurred. The events have not occurred yet, but that would be expected considering that some of these prophecies are expected to occur near the end times of man, or you know, at some time beyond where we are today in history. What I meant to say, and I apologize if I didn't say this, is that there have been no prophecies which have been shown to be inaccurate. There are no events that have occurred that would show that the prophecy was inaccurate.
That's phenomenal. Myself, I'll just speak for myself personally. Before I read any kind of book, especially a nonfiction book, something that I'm going to make a life decisions on, be it in business or motivational self-development, things like that, I usually do a little bit of research. I do a little bit of, I'm in the bookstore and I'm flipping through it and I'll read the introduction or the prologue or something like that. I'll look on the internet for reviews, or I'll just want some kind of supporting documentation, something that will give me some solace that what I'm about to take in as advice or as self-improvement or a life decision has authority. So at that, I wonder about the Bible. How did we come to accept the Bible? These particular 66 books and letters and writings, how did we come to accept this as the Bible? I'll be a little pious here, or maybe that's not the word, but as the holy word of God.
Well, again, as to the Christian Bible, there are two parts, so the Old Testament and the New Testament. Let me take the New Testament first. The New Testament emanates out of activities and events that occurred in the first century A.D. The folks that wrote what we now know as the 27 books of the New Testament were writing to others about those events. Those writings, many of them were duplicated, and they were circulated widely throughout the Roman Empire, particularly the eastern and northern part around the Mediterranean Sea. And so there are, in some cases, hundreds of copies of these individual books. We also know from people who wrote about these writings at a later time that they were being circulated. For example, people in the latter part of the first century and the second century, they would mention in their writings those that are the writings now that we know as the New Testament writings. And so they're both mentioned elsewhere and they're circulated, and many of those copies are writings that we have in archives. So eventually, because of the mass circulation of a lot of these writings, there was a determination as to whether they should be compiled, and that process occurred in a number of different ways. There were some groups of people that would accept certain ones and others that would accept others, but the New Testament we have today generally was a part of a canonization process, which means an acceptance process, that occurred in the early part of the 4th century. And so believers got together and decided which of the writings they would accept. There was some criteria. Who was the author? Is it generally accepted that what is written is consistent with acceptable theology of what they know about Jesus' life and his teachings and that type of thing? And so once these were determined, we now have the 27 books of the Bible, the New Testament, excuse me. The Old Testament writings have been around for a much longer period of time. and the Jewish scholars that predate Jesus, going back many hundreds of years, had accepted the books of the Old Testament. And we also have verification of those from some archaeology finds, such as the Dead Sea Scrolls, which was, I believe it was in the 1940s, that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found right next to the Dead Sea in some caves called the Caves of Qumran. And that was a significant find because it verified, with the exception of one book, that there was parts of every other book that matched the Old Testament that we have. So going back in time, we have some very early verification that what we're reading today in the Old Testament is what the Jewish scholars of the 1st century B.C. and the 2nd century B.C. were also reading, and they accepted as the Old Testament. So that's how the compilation of books occurred in both of those parts of the Christian Bible.
Great, thank you. We're going to take another break. Coming up, I do want to ask you some of the tougher questions, at least for myself, regarding the Bible, and that's about the idea of supernatural aspects, miracles, things like that. So we'll take a short little break and come right back. I want to touch on something that frankly troubles me, and I find difficult to answer when I'm asked about the Bible. Don't you think that certain supernatural aspects of the Bible, miracles and things that go against the laws of physics, those supernatural aspects of the Bible simply disqualify it as a historical document? Let me give you an example. We have seas parting. Michael, there's a talking donkey in the book of Numbers. A woman turning into a pillar of salt, not to mention walking on water and people rising from the dead. Michael, I'm not going to ask you to address these items particularly. However, I might challenge you in future episodes. But in general, we just would not accept these types of accounts from any other historical document, would we?
Joe, I agree that miracles are a difficult topic, but certainly something that gives us pause and something that grabs our attention. And I think that's what God, in the event that God is causing miracles to occur in history, that's what he had in mind. Something that would bring us to the point of challenge so that we'd be forced to look at what is taking place. And once upon a time, that's where I stopped, is simply saying that miracles, anything that violates the laws of nature and physics, as you had said, that simply doesn't happen. And we don't see that, so I'm going to disregard those things that make those claims. But what I was not doing at the time was I was not taking into account the evidence that pointed to the validity of these miracles. I mentioned earlier in our program that there are many miracles. I think Jesus performed 37 that is documented in the New Testament. Many of those are in front of lots of other folks. So there's lots of witnesses. And so if we were in a courtroom and we were putting the evidence before a jury, the jury would not be given any evidence that was in opposition to the fact that the miracle occurred. But instead, it would receive writings that claimed that not only it occurred, but there were many witnesses that saw each one of these. Some of them would be dozens and dozens, some would be smaller. So those types of things I think I took notice of in saying that there's always questions, but it only takes one true miracle, something that occurred that violated the laws of nature, for there to be a game-changing situation. It only takes one miracle. And I started believing in miracles when I started looking at nature itself and seeing the order and perfection. What's the likelihood of the solar system being in the condition that it's in, being so perfect in its order? That, to me, was a miracle. And so when I saw all of what I think to be the biological and non-biological miracles of order in nature, then that gave me reason to give the other miracles a chance as far as their accuracy as well. One led to another.
You know, one of the struggles that I have personally is the fact that we just don't see these types of supernatural occurrences in modern day faith. Now, if somebody were to say, well, Jesus did those things and okay, the apostles did those things. But we just, you know, we see miracles of nature and miracles of the cosmos and those types of miracles. But the miracles of healing and just those very specific supernatural occurrences, these stories seem to be isolated in the Bible, aren't they?
Well, I'm not sure about that. My guesstimation is that there are miracles that are taking place. They may or may not be of the same type that we read about in the New Testament. But let's look at the New Testament first before getting into modern-day type of events. The New Testament, particularly the Gospels, took place over just a couple years, 3-4 years. And then the book of Acts took place over approximately a 40-year period. It reads like it's a much shorter period of time, but it actually is 40 years.
I see.
And if God is involved in these things, if there is a God who is the creator, who Jesus is his son, Jesus is God, we would expect Jesus to verify who he says he was by miracles of this type. That's something I would expect. And then his followers to be able to further proclaim who he was during their lifetime, the ones that were with him, then there would be some expectation, I believe, of that as well, because that then verifies the truth of who Jesus is, and it verifies in some way the truth of what they wrote about. It is a confirming part of the whole story of what's taking place with Jesus and the followers that survive him. And so the fact that there's a concentration of miracles there is something that, in the event that he was who he said he was, I would expect that to occur. Following the book of Acts, which now we're going out into approximately 70 or 80 AD, then if there are other acts of miracles that occurred after that, they may be occurring, but they're just not documented in the same way, because the New Testament is not an attempt to document all of history from Jesus' public life onwards. It's just his life and the life of those people that followed him and what they did shortly after that. So miracles can be happening throughout history, and I believe that they are. They may not be as concentrated as that period of time, and on a today basis, I believe they certainly are happening, but we don't have them being documented in the same way as the New Testament miracles.
Or explained away in different ways, and frankly, we just might be blinded to them. We may, you know, our hearts may be hardened to recognize these miracles going on in our everyday life.
It's certainly true.
Yes. Do you think it's appropriate to look at the Bible as a historical record or simply as a religious book?
I think it's both, and there is an increasing amount of acceptability within the secular community as to the history that's documented in the Bible. The archaeological movement began approximately 100 years ago. Transportation increased from just boat to other types of things when it comes to crossing the Atlantic and the Pacific and going here and there. Also, institutions started funding archaeological expeditions in greater ways. And then today basis, there's also technological ways of performing the archaeological digs so that they're much more precise and do not harm the artifacts that are there. And so what I'm describing is that there's a progression of archaeological intensity, particularly in the Middle East. There's people from Europe and North America particularly who from the university settings are going to the Middle East and creating a archaeological expedition in so many different places that never had been. And so the more these archaeological expeditions take place, the more the Bible is confirmed. And so the last 100 years has confirmed more in the Bible from a historical standpoint than arguably the previous 1900. Coins, buildings, writings, all kinds of things that confirm the people and places that were in the Bible. There were arguments just as recently as 50 to 100 years ago that cities and rulers and other people groups that are mentioned in the Bible never existed. But in fact, they are being confirmed more and more by the archaeological digs that are taking place. So, is it a historical document? I think that it is becoming a primary source document for archaeologists, speaks to the accuracy of the history that's mentioned, And is it a religious book? It certainly is. It points to the fact, undeniably, that there are claims that we are not evolved, but rather created beings by someone who loves us and calls us to be with him forever.
Outside of the religious realm, you kind of touched on this a little bit, Michael. So what you're saying is the Bible currently, all the archaeological findings now that are biblically related are doing nothing but confirming what we find in the Bible. And because of that, more and more, the Bible is being used as frankly, as a religious book, of course, but also by archaeological teams and scientists as a historical document.
All that is correct, yes. The depth of evidence that confirms the statements of historical fact continue to build, and in the eyes of many experts, I can't say that I can claim all of them, but in the eyes of many experts, it has become a primary source document. When there is a place that has not been found physically, the Bible can be used as a research document and is used as a research document today by secular archaeologists to find what evidence there is there in those writings to then help them piece together where they would go in order to find these places.
Give us your final statement, your final argument for the Bible being a book of history.
The writers of the Bible I find to be extremely detailed in their writing, as if they knew that they were going to be scrutinized as to the accuracy of what they were writing. They wanted to be able to be tested as to what they were saying. And the more that secular writings and history that comes from archaeological finds verify this, without there being any contradiction, then it appears that the Bible is accurate in every way.
Do you have any additional resources that we can go to as we do our own research into this subject?
There's a book, there's many books regarding this, and so there's a book that has a lot of history with respect to many issues that I use as a resource book. It's called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, written by Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. There are many writings, many books by an author named N.T. Wright, and one of the ones I read in preparation for our show is called Simply Christian. And not for today's topic, but I would generally refer people to the three case books written by Lee Strobel. He has the Case for Faith, the Case for Christ, and the Case for Creation. And each one of those, he interviews many experts in order to cover lots of territory with respect to questions that come out of the Christian faith, questions about it, and meant to be scrutinized by those who both believe and don't believe. So those are things that I would suggest to your listeners that they might want to look at those books for purposes of both this issue and some others.
Lee Strobel really does an amazing job of breaking down these arguments in an easy-to-understand manner. His books, I've read all three of them, as well as the writings of Ravi Zacharias and William Lane Craig, were key in my walk of faith personally. As we wrap up, Michael, I just want to say thank you. We certainly appreciate your time again today. And as we did last week, go ahead and let us know how we can get in touch with you if need be.
Well, I'm on Twitter, and my signature there is at Michael Minot. I also have a website, michaelminot.com. And if you'd like to get in touch with me personally, you can use the contact information on my website, and I'd be more than happy to get back with you.
The links to the resources mentioned on today's episode can be found at onfaithsedge.com/003. Again, that's onfaithsedge.com/003. If you want to comment on today's show, you can simply go to onfaithsedge.com and leave a message, or you can send me an email to joe@onfaithsedge.com. I check my emails all the time and I respond very quickly. Next episode, we'll discuss apparent contradictions in the Bible. Because let's face it, if the Bible truly contradicts itself, then can it really be called the Word of God? Until next week, remember, if you're going to pray for a bike, you might as well pray for a red one. What did I just step in? Hey, who forgot to let the dog out?